A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the eye. Aye, and it's a sharp question. We've talked before about the agency's role in monitoring Iran's nuclear program, but the ground has shifted. Iran has walked back cooperation to the point of near-total non-cooperation. Inspectors are effectively locked out of centrifuge workshops, enrichment sites beyond the declared ones, and uranium stockpile audits. So the question is blunt. In that environment, what useful function does the IIII actually hold as a nuclear watchdog? If Iran treats the agency as a hostile party and denies meaningful access, what utility does it offer in monitoring the program? There's a lot to unpack here.
It's exactly the right moment to ask. As of June 2026, Iran's cooperation is at its lowest point since the 2015 nuclear deal. The IAEI's latest quarterly report, published in May, confirms zero access to key sites for 18 consecutive months. Not reduced access. That's an inspector standing at a gate that never opens. But here's what most coverage misses. The agency doesn't just go home. It shifts modes entirely.
Let's step back and ask. What is the IAEI actually supposed to do when a member state says no?
The IAEI's statutory mandate is specific. It verifies safeguards agreements under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's it. It's not an intelligence agency, it's not an enforcement body, it has no police powers. Its job is to confirm that declared nuclear material is not being diverted to weapons use, and to detect any undeclared nuclear material or activities. The legal framework is the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement, plus the additional protocol, which Iran signed in 2003 but stopped implementing in February 2021. The additional protocol is the thing that gives inspectors the authority to visit undeclared sites on short notice. Without it, they're restricted to declared facilities only.
Iran has gone further than just suspending the additional protocol.
In September 2023, Iran stopped providing access to centrifuge component manufacturing workshops and uranium mines. It revoked the designations of multiple experienced inspectors, essentially blacklisting specific individuals. It removed surveillance cameras and enrichment monitors from several facilities. And critically, since February 2021, Iran has refused to allow the IIII to service the monitoring equipment that remains. So you have cameras with dead batteries and full memory cards sitting behind locked doors.
The nuclear equivalent of a Ring doorbell that's been unplugged for 2 years.
That's not far off. But here's the paradox that makes this question so interesting. Iran's non-cooperation doesn't automatically render the IIII useless. It shifts the agency's function from direct monitoring to something else entirely. Inference, anomaly detection, and political signaling. The watchdog still has teeth, they're just different teeth.
To understand what the I can still do, we need to look under the hood at how verification works when you can't walk through the door.
The core concept is what the agency calls continuity of knowledge. Even without physical access, you can maintain a partial picture through multiple overlapping data streams. Think of it like a mosaic where some tiles have been removed. You can still see the shape, and you can definitely spot if someone's rearranging the remaining pieces. The agency uses three main tools right now. First, remote monitoring of enrichment levels at Natanz and Fordow via online enrichment monitors. Iran has not disabled these. They're still transmitting data. Second, analysis of uranium particle samples from past inspections. These environmental swipe samples are incredibly durable forensic evidence. Third, satellite imagery analysis from commercial providers like Maxar and Planet Labs.
Let's go deeper on each of those. The enrichment monitors. What are they actually measuring?
Online enrichment monitors are devices installed on the cascade piping at centrifuge plants. They measure the uranium hexafluoride gas as it flows through, detecting the ratio of uranium-235 to uranium-238 in real time. The IIII can see enrichment levels, flow rates, and cascade configurations remotely. At Natanz and Fordow, Iran has kept these running. So the agency knows, with reasonable confidence, that Iran has been enriching uranium to 60% at those declared sites since April 2021, and that the stockpile of material enriched to that level has grown.
60% is a number that sounds technical, but has specific meaning in this world.
It's the number that makes everyone nervous. Weapons grade is 90%. At 60%, you've done most of the work. The physics of enrichment is nonlinear. Getting from natural uranium, which is 0.7% uranium-235, to 5% reactor grade takes about two-thirds of the total effort. Going from 5 to 60% takes most of the remaining third. The jump from 60 to 90 is comparatively small. So 60% enrichment puts Iran in what analysts call a breakout posture, capable of producing enough highly enriched uranium for one bomb in a time frame measured in months, not years.
That breakout time has been shrinking.
In 2019, the IAEI estimated Iran's breakout time at roughly 12 months. By 2026, that estimate has collapsed to between 3 and 6 months. That's the worst-case scenario, assuming Iran expels inspectors entirely and throws every centrifuge at weapons-grade production. But here's the critical point. The IAEI cannot confirm this without access. The estimate is a modeled worst-case baseline. The actual capability could be shorter or longer. The agency is explicit about this uncertainty in its reports, and that uncertainty itself is a finding.
Which brings us to the particle analysis. Explain how that works and why it matters when you can't get new samples.
Environmental sampling is one of the most powerful tools in the IAEI's arsenal, and it works retroactively. Inspectors take swipe samples from surfaces inside nuclear facilities, walls, piping, floors. These swipes collect microscopic particles of uranium. Back at the IAEI's laboratories in Cybersdorf, Austria, and at Partner Labs in the network, scientists analyze individual particles using secondary ion mass spectrometry. They can determine not just the enrichment level of each particle, but its isotopic fingerprint, which can reveal where the uranium came from and what processes it's been through. A single particle enriched to 83.7%, found at a site that's only supposed to enrich to 5%, is a smoking gun.
That's exactly what happened at Merivan.
The IAEI detected particles of uranium enriched to 83.7% at the undeclared Merivan site. That's just below weapons grade. The particles were found on environmental samples taken during a 2022 inspection. So the agency was analyzing two-year-old swabs and finding evidence of enrichment far beyond what Iran had declared anywhere. Iran claimed it was contamination, particles that had drifted from somewhere else. The IIEI assessed that explanation as technically implausible. The particle composition, the enrichment level, the isotopic signature, none of it matched Iran's declared inventory. This is exactly how inference-based monitoring works. You can't get in the door today, but the forensic trail from 2 years ago tells you what was happening behind it.
That's like finding a fingerprint on a door handle from a party you weren't invited to, and the print belongs to someone who definitely wasn't on the guest list.
The fingerprint doesn't wash off. Uranium particles are chemically stable and can persist on surfaces for years. The IIII has a growing archive of environmental samples from sites it visited before access was cut off. Each sample is a time capsule. As analytical techniques improve, and they have, dramatically, old samples yield new information. The agency can go back to swabs from 2018 and run them through better instruments in 2026 and find things it missed the first time.
The archive itself is an intelligence asset.
A growing one. And that connects to the third tool, satellite imagery. The IIII doesn't operate its own satellites, obviously. It purchases imagery from commercial providers. Maxar's WorldView satellites can resolve objects as small as 30 centimeters. Planet Labs operates a constellation of over 200 small satellites that image the entire Earth's landmass daily at 3 to 5 meter resolution. The IIII's safeguards analysts watch for construction activity, vehicle movements, changes in building footprints, new security perimeters, steam plumes from cooling towers, and the distinctive roof shapes of centrifuge halls.
What can satellite imagery actually tell you? And what can't it?
It can tell you that something is happening. It cannot tell you what that something is. In 2025, satellite imagery revealed construction of a new centrifuge hall at the Natanz complex, a large rectangular building with the characteristic roof ventilation pattern of a cascade hall. The IEEI could see the building going up. It could estimate the floor area and infer the potential number of centrifuges, but it couldn't tell whether those centrifuges were IR1s, which are first generation and relatively inefficient, or IR9s, which are advanced and can enrich uranium much faster. Only on-site inspection can confirm centrifuge type, feed rate, and product enrichment, so the imagery creates a question that only access can answer. And when Iran denies access, the unanswered question itself becomes the finding.
The absence of evidence becomes evidence of absence, or rather, the denial of access becomes evidence of something to hide.
That's exactly the shift in the IEEI's function. In a cooperative environment, the agency provides positive assurance. We have verified that all nuclear material remains in peaceful use. In a non-cooperative environment, the agency provides negative assurance. We cannot verify that all nuclear material remains in peaceful use. That second statement is not a failure. It's the most important thing the agency can say. It's a tripwire.
Technical tools only get you so far. The real question is, what happens when those tools fail? And that's where the IEEI's political function kicks in.
This is where the agency's role becomes genuinely fascinating. The IIII's only real weapon is credibility. Its assessments are trusted by the P5+1, the European Union, and the broader international community. When the IAEI says we cannot verify the peaceful nature of Iran's program, that statement carries more weight than any intelligence agency's assessment. It's not an intelligence finding. It's a legal determination under a treaty framework.
That matters because it provides the basis for international action.
Without IAEI confirmation of non-compliance, unilateral military strikes or sanctions lack legitimacy under international law. The agency's reports become the authoritative baseline. Every UN Security Council resolution on Iran's nuclear program has cited IIII findings. Every sanctions package has been justified by IIII reports. The agency's Board of Governors resolutions, which require a majority vote, not unanimity, create a cascade of diplomatic consequences. The 2025 Board of Governors resolution censuring Iran passed with 30 votes in favor, 2 against, and 3 abstentions. That's a 30-2 vote. Russia and China were the two against. The resolution explicitly cited the IIEI's inability to verify the peaceful nature of Iran's program as the basis for censure.
30-2 is a diplomatic landslide.
And it matters because it isolates Iran politically, even if the Security Council is paralyzed by vetoes. The Board of Governors resolution triggers mandatory reporting to the Security Council. It activates national sanctions authorities in member states. It shapes the risk assessments of banks, insurers, and shipping companies. The IAEI doesn't impose sanctions, but its findings are the factual predicate that makes sanctions legally defensible.
The agency functions as a kind of evidentiary gatekeeper for the entire international response.
And that's why Director General Grossi has been so careful about the agency's technical neutrality. In February 2026, he made a statement that I think captures the entire institutional philosophy. He said, "We are not a spy agency, we are a verification agency." That's not just rhetoric. It's a structural constraint that makes the IEEI's findings more durable than intelligence assessments. Intelligence agencies have political masters. Their findings can be dismissed as politically motivated. The IIEI's findings are produced by scientists following documented procedures, calibrated instruments, and peer-reviewed analytical methods. Iran can call the IIEI a Western intelligence front, and it does, frequently, but it can't produce a competing technical assessment that anyone else takes seriously.
There's a tension here, though. Iran treats the IIEI as a hostile party. Inspectors are accused of espionage. Specific individuals are blacklisted. The relationship is adversarial. Does that degrade the agency's credibility or sharpen it?
It sharpens it, paradoxically. When a state is cooperating, the IIEI's conclusions are sometimes dismissed as rubber stamping. Oh, they're just reading what the state tells them. When a state is actively obstructing, the IAEI's persistence in documenting that obstruction becomes evidence of its independence. Every quarterly report that says Iran is not cooperating is a demonstration that the agency won't be bullied into silence. The hostility validates the watchdog.
Like a health inspector who gets locked out of a restaurant kitchen. The fact that they're standing on the sidewall taking notes is the review.
The review gets published. The quarterly reports are public documents. Anyone can read them. The safeguards implementation section, which lists unresolved issues, is where the real story unfolds. It's a running log of questions Iran hasn't answered, access it hasn't granted, and discrepancies it hasn't explained. The headlines focus on enrichment levels and stockpile numbers, but the safeguard section is the canary in the coal mine.
Let's talk about the shadow monitoring ecosystem. The IIEI doesn't operate in isolation. There's a coordination with national technical means from the United States, Israel, and European allies. How does that work without the agency becoming an intelligence front?
This is a delicate dance. The IIEI does not formally share intelligence with member states, and member states do not formally share intelligence with the IIEI. What happens is more subtle. States with advanced intelligence capabilities, satellite constellations, signals intelligence, human sources, develop their own assessments of Iran's nuclear activities. When those assessments identify something concerning, states can provide information to the IIEI through a mechanism called third-party information. The agency then evaluates that information independently, using its own methods, and decides whether to pursue it.
The state provides the tip, not the evidence.
The state says, we have reason to believe there's undeclared activity at this location. The IIEI then requests access to that location under the safeguards agreement. If Iran denies access, which it almost always does for undeclared sites, the denial itself becomes a safeguards violation. The agency doesn't need to confirm what's happening inside. The refusal to allow verification is the violation. This is how the Mary Von case unfolded. The IIEI had information suggesting undeclared activities. It requested access. Iran eventually granted a limited inspection in 2022, which produced the swipes that later revealed the 83.7% particles.
The IIEI provides the framework, states provide the data, and the combination produces findings that neither could generate alone.
That framework is what makes the findings legally actionable. If the United States or Israel simply announced that Iran had enriched uranium to near weapons grade at an undeclared site, Iran would dismiss it as propaganda, and much of the world would shrug. When the IAEI reports it, based on its own laboratory analysis, it becomes a finding of fact under international law. The same information, different institutional source, completely different political weight.
This raises an uncomfortable question, though. What happens if the IAEI simply says we don't know? Does the agency become irrelevant, or does it become more important?
This is the core tension, and I think the answer is uncomfortable in both directions. The IIEI's utility is greatest precisely when it is most powerless, because its inability to verify becomes the most powerful political signal. A report that says we cannot confirm the peaceful nature of Iran's program triggers diplomatic processes that a report saying everything is fine does not. So in one sense, the agency is more important now than it was in 2015 when Iran was fully cooperating under the JCPOA.
There's a threshold.
There has to be. If Iran's non-cooperation reaches the point where the IIEI has no monitoring capability at all, no enrichment monitors, no inspector presence, no access to any sites, then the agency's reports become purely speculative. We don't know anything, and we can't even say what we don't know. That's not a useful finding. That's an admission of irrelevance. We're not there yet. The IIEI still has inspectors in the country, still has enrichment monitors at Natanz and Fordow, still has a baseline of knowledge from decades of inspections. But the trend line is clear.
That trend line can be measured. The prompt asks about utility, and one metric for that is inspection days.
This is the number I think about constantly. In 2019, Iran allowed roughly 1,200 inspector days per quarter. That's a substantial verification presence, multiple teams, multiple sites, sustained access. By the first quarter of 2026, that number had dropped to 47 inspector days per quarter. That's not a verification regime, that's a token presence. It's the nuclear equivalent of a diplomatic attaché who gets a quarterly tour of the lobby.
From 1,200 to 47. That's a 96% reduction.
Every one of those 47 days is at a declared site that Iran has already prepared for inspection. The element of surprise is gone. The ability to visit undeclared locations is gone. The ability to inspect centrifuge component workshops, where Iran could be manufacturing advanced centrifuges for an undeclared facility, is gone. So what are those 47 inspector days actually verifying? Very little, in terms of positive assurance. But their existence matters. As long as there are inspectors in the country, Iran has not fully expelled the III. That's a political threshold that even North Korea eventually crossed.
The North Korea comparison is instructive.
It's the cautionary tale. North Korea was an ONPT member. It had III safeguards. In 1993, it denied access to two undeclared sites. The III reported the non-compliance to the Security Council. In 1994, North Korea announced its withdrawal from the IAEA, not the NPT, just the IAEA. The agency's inspectors remained in the country in a reduced capacity until 2002, when North Korea expelled them entirely. In 2003, North Korea withdrew from the NPT. At each step, the IAEA's reports provided the factual basis for international response. But once North Korea had fully withdrawn and expelled inspectors, the agency's role shifted from verification to observation. It monitors North Korea from outside the country using satellite imagery and open-source information. It maintains a standing item on its Board of Governors agenda titled Application of Safeguards in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, but it cannot verify anything.
The North Korea case is the endpoint of the trajectory Iran is on. The IIII becomes a documentation unit for a state that's outside the system entirely.
The key difference is that Iran has not withdrawn from the NPT. It remains a party to the treaty. It still has a safeguards agreement in force. It still allows, barely, some IAEI presence. That legal distinction matters enormously. As long as Iran is inside the NPT, the IIEI has a legal mandate to verify its compliance. Iran's non-cooperation is a violation of its obligations, not a termination of them. The agency can continue to report non-compliance to the Security Council indefinitely. Every quarterly report is a legal finding that Iran is in breach.
Which brings us to the breakout question. With reduced access, the IAEA's estimate of Iran's breakout time has shrunk. But how reliable is an estimate built on incomplete data?
It's a worst-case model, and the agency is explicit about that. The estimate assumes Iran would use all its declared centrifuges at maximum efficiency, that it has no undeclared enrichment capacity, and that it can convert enriched uranium hexafluoride gas into weapons, usable metal without detection. The model doesn't account for undeclared facilities, which could shorten the timeline, or for technical bottlenecks, which could lengthen it. The point of the breakout estimate is not to predict what Iran will do. It's to establish the minimum warning time the international community would have if Iran decided to sprint for a bomb. 3 to 6 months is not a lot of time. It's enough to convene a Security Council meeting and not much else.
The breakout estimate is less a measurement and more a policy input. It tells decision makers how much time they don't have.
That's a valid function. The IIEI's job is not to stop Iran from getting a bomb. It's to provide the information that enables others to make decisions about stopping Iran from getting a bomb. The distinction is crucial. The agency doesn't have the authority to impose consequences. It can only report facts. But the facts it reports determine what consequences are available.
Let's address three misconceptions that show up in coverage of this topic. First, the III is powerless without access.
This is the most common one, and it's wrong in an interesting way. The IIEI is less powerful without access to verify, but it is not powerless. Its power shifts from positive verification to negative documentation. It can't tell you what Iran is doing, but it can authoritatively tell you that Iran won't let it check what Iran is doing. That statement, Iran is obstructing verification, is itself a finding with legal and political consequences. The agency's power is in its credibility, not its access. Access is a tool. Credibility is the weapon.
Second, the IIEI can verify everything with satellite imagery.
This one drives me up the wall. Satellite imagery can detect construction, vehicle movements, and thermal signatures. It cannot detect enrichment levels. cannot identify uranium particle composition, cannot confirm the presence of nuclear material, and cannot distinguish between a centrifuge hall and a conventional factory with similar architecture. The IAEI's own safeguards documents are explicit about this. Imagery is a trigger for further investigation, not a substitute for on-site inspection. When you see coverage saying satellite images reveal Iran's nuclear activities, what they almost always mean is satellite images reveal construction that could be nuclear-related. That's an important qualifier.
Third, Iran has completely expelled the IAEI.
Iran still allows limited access to Natanz and Fordow for enrichment monitoring. The IAEI still has inspectors in the country, a small number, severely restricted, but present. Iran has not disabled the online enrichment monitors at those facilities. It is not formally withdrawn from the ONPT. It has not expelled all inspectors. The situation is bad. 47 inspector days per quarter is a skeleton crew, but it's not zero. And the difference between 47 and zero is enormous in legal and diplomatic terms. Zero means North Korea. 47 means there's still a thread of verification, still a legal basis for action, still a presence that can be built upon if a diplomatic resolution emerges.
Where does that leave us? Let's pull out three concrete takeaways for understanding what the IAEI is actually doing right now.
First, the IAEI's value in a non-cooperative environment is not in direct monitoring, but in creating what I'd call a verification deficit. The agency's reports document the gap between what it needs to verify and what Iran allows it to verify. That gap is the tripwire. When the gap widens to a certain point, and we're approaching it, the international community is forced to act, because the alternative is accepting that a state can pursue nuclear capabilities with no oversight. The IAEI's reports don't stop Iran from enriching. They stop the world from pretending it isn't happening.
The tripwire, not the fence.
Second, for policymakers and informed observers, the key metric to watch is not access, it's inspection days. The number of inspector days Iran allows per quarter tells you more about the state of the verification regime than any headline about enrichment levels, 1,200 in 2019, 47 in the first quarter of 2026. That number is the real indicator of cooperation. If it drops to zero, we're in North Korea territory. If it rises, even modestly, that's a signal of diplomatic engagement. Track the inspector day count in the quarterly reports. Third, follow the IAEI's quarterly reports themselves. They're published in March, June, September, and December. They're publicly available on the IAEI website. Skip the headlines about enrichment levels. Those are important, but they're the surface. Go to the safeguards implementation section. That's where the agency lists unresolved issues, denied access requests, unanswered questions about uranium particles, and discrepancies in Iran's declarations. That section is a running log of everything Iran doesn't want you to know. It's dry reading, but it's the most transparent window into what the verification regime can and cannot see.
Read the footnotes of the apocalypse.
The footnotes are where the bodies are buried.
Let's think forward. If Iran continues its current trajectory, at what point does the IAEI's inability to verify become indistinguishable from the agency's irrelevance? Is there a threshold of non-cooperation that breaks the system entirely?
I think there is a threshold, and we're closer to it than most people realize. The threshold isn't zero inspector days, it's the point where the IAEI can no longer maintain continuity of knowledge. That's the technical term for the agency's ability to account for all nuclear material in Iran from the last point of full verification forward. Once the gap in knowledge exceeds what can be reconstructed from satellite imagery, environmental sampling archives, and remote monitoring, the agency loses its ability to make any meaningful statement about Iran's nuclear activities. At that point, the quarterly reports become a formality, a ritual recitation of everything the agency cannot do. That's not verification. That's an obituary.
The Iran case is a stress test for the entire non-proliferation regime.
That's the bigger picture. If the IAEI cannot function with a hostile but technically cooperative state, and Iran is still technically inside the NPT, what happens when a state like Saudi Arabia or Turkey pursues enrichment under similar conditions? The Iran precedent will shape how future proliferators engage with the safeguard system. If Iran demonstrates that you can reduce III access to near zero without facing consequences beyond resolutions and censures, the non-proliferation regime's deterrent value collapses. The agency's greatest weakness, its lack of enforcement power, is also its greatest strength, because it forces the international community to own the consequences of non-compliance. But that only works if the international community is willing to own them.
The IIEI can document the violation. It can't fix it.
That's the uncomfortable conclusion. The IIEI's utility in the Iran case is real, it's measurable, and it's indispensable. But it's not sufficient. The agency can tell you that a state is cheating. It can tell you how badly. It can even tell you approximately how much time you have before the cheating produces a bomb. But it cannot stop the cheating. That's someone else's job. The watchdog barks. It doesn't bite.
The question Daniel is really asking, I think, is whether the barking still matters if the intruder knows the dog is on a chain.
It matters if the neighbors are listening. And in this case, the neighbors are the permanent members of the Security Council, the European Union, the global financial system, and every state that has ever considered pursuing enrichment under safeguards. The bark is the basis for everything that follows. Without it, there's no legal justification for sanctions, no diplomatic isolation, no military option framed as a last resort. The bark is the thing that turns unilateral action into international enforcement.
The IIEI is less a watchdog and more a notary public for the apocalypse.
That's darker than I'd put it, but not inaccurate. It witnesses, it documents, it certifies. The certification is what makes everything else possible. And that's not a small thing. It's just not a satisfying thing if what you want is a solution.
Few things in nuclear diplomacy are.
No, they really aren't.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, geologists surveying the highlands of Papua New Guinea proposed that the strange flat-floored valleys they encountered were the dried-out basins of enormous subglacial lakes formed when glaciers covered the island's central cordillera during the last ice age. The theory was mainstream for nearly two decades before field mapping in the late 1930s proved the valleys were carved by ordinary river erosion.
Subglacial lakes in Papua New Guinea, right on the equator.
Glacial geology taking a real left turn there.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We're at My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. The footnotes are where the bodies are buried.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.